Beats, Ahmed.
Bet Ahmed Ahmed. Bet, that bet Ahmed. Hello, sorry. okay, so Betat Hashem, with Hashem's help, we're going to learn a little bit of introduction to Beitza in the next week. See what we can learn. Okay, so the Masechet, let's do an introduction first before we start. The Masechet is called Beitza. It gets the name Beitza from the beginning Mishnah, which talks about an egg that's laid on Yom Tov. But really the whole Masechet is about the laws of Yom Tov. And it could have been called Masechet Yom Tov rather than Masechet Beitza. But it's called Beitza, and Chazal decided. Obviously there's deeper things going on, but actually you only see Beitza at the beginning, and once you finish with the Beitza in the first line, we don't really come across the Beitza again. Right? But that's what the Masechet's called. It's all about the laws of Yom Tov mainly, what you can do on Yom Tov. Now really, as we all know, Tzat Hashem, Yom Tov is basically the same as Shabbos. Except for, as the Torah told us, Ochel Nefesh, that you can do malakas which are related to the preparation of food. So the Gemara itself is going to look at the sort of things that you can and can't do on Yom Tov. And that's what we're going to get most of the malakas for how we act on Yom Tov. Now the main subject of the first perek of Beitza is muksa. What's muksa? Muksa is not a matter which is only specific to Yom Tov. Obviously, muksa is on Shabbos and Yom Tov. So why dafka here? Why not bring muksa in the laws of Shabbos? Why bring in the laws of Yom Tov? Because there are some differences between Yom Tov and Shabbos regarding muksa.
Was the muksa always found in Shabbos?
I think they're found here, not there. I think Lina, I can't remember exactly, but it's brought a lot over here. So the Schottenstein art scroll has a very nice summary of the laws of Muksa. So because Muksa is going to get mentioned a lot, it's useful for us to review the halachas of Muksa, so that we know what we're talking about when we come across it in the Gemara. Yeah, working. Yeah. So the laws of muksa. So the Schottenstein here brings three different reasons why we have muksa. Right, muksa is rabbinic, as we know. The general law of muksa is you're not allowed to touch stuff that breaks Shabbos. Right, in a nutshell, if you want to sum up for a kid, what does muksa mean? Don't touch stuff that breaks Shabbos. Right, but it's a bit more involved than that. But that's the general idea. So why do we have it at all? It's not a Torah law. You wanna join? We're learning Beitza. Hi Michael. Rav Mordi's not here this week, so we're just gonna learn Beitza a little together. So we have a Tov. So it's not in the Torah. Also written by my wife.
That's the best book.
My wife wrote it.
Your wife wrote it?
For a cousin. Talk. Anyway, plug. where are we? Yes, so laws of muksa. Okay, so muksa is not from the Torah. There's no law in the Torah that you're not allowed to touch stuff that breaks Shabbos. Right? So where does it come? So it's a rabbinic. The rabbis made the rule of muksa. Why did they make the rule? So Schottenstein over here gives us three different reasons. Three different reasons for the laws of muksa. Any offers?
Three
different reasons why the rabbis decided to create the law of muksa. Anyone?
People wouldn't conduct business.
It doesn't lead to doing actions.
Okay, so one reason is offense, right? As offense, so that you don't. You don't pick up a pen and then absentmindedly start writing, so you're not allowed to touch a pen, in order that you won't then actually do the malacha, right? The action, the malacha. So in order to protect that, you stick a fence around it, and the fence that the rabbis created is, don't touch it.
Same thing with playing instruments. You might come to fix it.
by come to fix it, right, again, of du'a malacha that you're not allowed to do, which is fixing an instrument, right? And therefore, in order to prevent doing that, they said don't. So that's one reason.
Well,
there's two
not
more.
Only an action,
yes,
but an idea, such as conducting business. You may not be exchanging money on Shabbos, but you're dealing with business.
Right, so you're not allowed to do business. Again, it's not a muksa issue, but the same idea is on the laws of speech and of doing business. There's nothing wrong with it halakhically. You're allowed to discuss whatever you like halakhically, but Rabbi has declared that you're not allowed to discuss business in case you come to do business. Right, the same idea. But back to muksa itself specifically, why am I not allowed to touch certain items or move them? Yes,
Rabbi Shmuel. It's similar to the Mishkan.
Okay, go on. Meaning?
The service of Hashem in Bar Midbar, and certain things were those were turning on Malachi, and you are not allowed to do in the Mishkan.
Okay.
On those particular days.
So here, muksa is like we said in the first example, in order to prevent us from doing any of those 39 malachas. So for that reason, yeah, you're right. But it's really that's in the first reason, meaning to stop us doing any of the malachas. So the two other reasons that he brings are, firstly, in order to make a difference between Shabbos and the rest of the week. Right? That we don't act on Shabbos the way we act the rest of the week. We have to stop and think. Can I move this? Can I pick this up? Can I act in this way? Right? If we acted the way we would normally act during the rest of the week, there wouldn't be such a difference between Shabbos or Yom Tov and the rest of the week. So in order to make a difference, to make it clear that today's a different day, we don't forget it's Shabbos, which is a different than forgetting that I'm not allowed to do this malacha. Right? I don't want to forget that it's actually a different day. So the rabbis decided that that we're not going to deal or touch or move things that we would on the weekday, that are related to the weekday. If I don't actually need it for Shabbos, I shouldn't be touching it, even though it has nothing to do. For example, a tin of chickpeas can go in salad, but something that needs cooking, right? Something that needs cooking and is in a tin, a can or tin, I don't know, American tin. Right? Like, what needs cooking that's in a tent? That you can't eat raw. Do they have such a thing?
Right. Tomato paste.
They have like beans that you have to cook them.
So beans, yeah. Like, you can eat cold beans, but let's say you don't want to eat cold beans. Right? We're not at that
tomato
stage
paste.
In life. Right? And it's in a can. Right? That's muksa. Right? Even though there's absolutely nothing wrong with it, it's just a can. It's not doing anything. I'm not home. Right? I'm not allowed to deal with that. I need to know today's Shabbos, and I can't do it if it's not ready for Shabbos. I'm not using it on Shabbos. I can't move it. So that's number two.
That's the reason it says Zachor during Shabbat. Why do we have to? Why does it say Zachor? Why do we have to? Because on Shabbat, everything that we normally do, we don't do on Shabbat. Most of the Lamentet things that we have to remember all this on Shabbat.
Right. Also, for us, even without the laws of muksa, we wouldn't necessarily need this rule so much, because in our day and age, everything is muksa. Like, everything you've got to think about and touch, and not electric, it's all right. But in the past, you wouldn't necessarily, unless you were working. If you're just at home, there wouldn't necessarily be stuff that you'd have to actually think about doing malachot. Right? You wouldn't be doing any malachot. Your wife might be cooking in the kitchen, but apart from that, if you weren't working, you'd be sitting there. There wouldn't be such a difference between that day and a normal day. Whereas now, even without the laws of muksa, we know we can't touch this, we have to be careful, and we have that heker, that recognition ourselves. But certainly in the past, it was more of a need to have a recognition that today's a different day.
I mean, nowadays you have cell phones, you have internet, you have the car.
Right. Interesting. Although you can go in the car. It's interesting. You can't. Bli neder. I'm not Hosek, obviously. But it's surprising. You can go into a car. You can open an open car and go in and take something out. I think because you're not moving it. I don't know if that's...
You have to make sure the light is around.
Although you would have thought that would have been a classic books item that you shouldn't touch. But I see, that's why the laws are detailed.
Well, I was thinking driving.
Obviously, with gradation. Don't drive a car.
Right. No, I'm saying,
there's no light
on there.
I mean, I don't
really see a problem.
Right, but it's a
Muxa
item.
Right.
I mean...
So are you
driving? So you are, but the question is why? Don't know. It may be that the actual car's not moving, just the door, but then the door's moving. I don't know. That.
No, you can still
fix the
car.
It's like opening up your house.
You
can't use our chalice.
You can buy your car, but he connects the battery, so there's no electricity.
The truth is, you can, but even an item, we're going to go through the list, that is Muxa, you can still use it on Shabbos if you're using it for a reason. Like the classic example is a hammer, right? A hammer is Muxa because it's not used on Shabbos, but you can use a hammer on Shabbos if you're using it to crack open nuts, using it for a reason that you need to use it on Shabbos, that you're allowed to use it. So even muksa things that are inherently muksa can lose their muksa status if you specifically use them for Shabbat. Okay, so that's two reasons. Let's just recap. The two reasons that we've got so far are, firstly, as a fence to stop us doing malachot. Second reason is in order to make the day different, so that I know today is not a weekday. Third reason given is for people who don't work during the week in a way that involves malacha, they wouldn't necessarily know, have a difference between a weekday and a whole day. For example, people who are retired, like people who are too young to work. If they didn't have the laws of Muxa, they wouldn't be doing anything different. They would just be like a normal weekday for them. Similar, a little bit to the second. Well, it brings us to the second.
Funny because when I retired, I asked the rabbi if I had to observe Shabbat. Of course, there's no difference.
Why every day for Shabbat?
So during the week, you know, I work during the week, I work on Shabbat or so.
Exactly, so that you're exactly in this category, right? Because what's the difference between those two? Right? Answer: Muxa.
That way you can go to the car, but there's no lights coming, right?
You can.
But then also you can't even touch let's say it's something that you can't get everything from, like touching
sunflower seeds.
Because it's, you know?
You can if you're going to make a use out of them.
There's no more use.
So there is a use in the car, because you need to open the car to get the stuff that's in the car.
Right.
So you created a use. Maybe that's the answer. If you can create a use for it that's allowed on Shabbat, like a hammer. You weren't going to use a hammer, and then you had someone brought around some nuts for Shabbos lunch as a gift. And you're like, well, how are we going to open these? Oh, I've got a hammer in the car.
You can.
A can opener.
Can opener.
Yeah, if you need to open a can, yeah. So you.
The main thing is that you need a reason to use it.
Right. So
there's no reason. It's
so a lot of the laws of Muxa depend on whether something is prepared or not for Shabbos. Right. The law, which is why, if you prepare it beforehand, it's not Muxa. So let's see anyway. Here he
for
now
example,
brings.
Cholent.
For example, a cholent. Meaning?
Namely, you prepare a cholent beforehand so you can enjoy it with a hot meal.
Okay, could be. Yeah. Tov. All right, so here are seven different categories of muksa. Right, let's list them. First one, muksa mechamet chiswon kis, as it's called in Hebrew. Muksa mechamet, on account of mechamet, chiswon kis.
I'm sorry, chiswon. Where are you?
I'm in the. I don't know if it's in that section. It's before the beginnings in the introduction
okay.
to the tractate.
Okay.
Okay. So here, chesron kis means what? Cheshbon kis is loss of pocket, out of pocket. Right? Muksa from something that's going to be out of pocket. What does that mean? It means if I'm worried that I'm going to cause me a loss, I'm not allowed to touch it. Something that's expensive, even if it's not otherwise muksa. For example, he brings an example here. The example brought by the Gemara is a shechting knife. Right? You want to be getting, there's nothing wrong with a shechting knife. Knives are perfectly fine. You use them on your table, right?
And shechting
knife you only use for shechting, but you could use it to cut fruit open. You could use it for other stuff.
Or
barber's razor, right? Stuff that you're worried that might become damaged. It would become muksa, is muksa, and you're not allowed to touch it. It doesn't say here, I'm assuming that the reason is probably because we don't want a person to be bothered on Shabbos and be worried about
playing.
Don't touch that. Right? Not because of danger, but because of monetary, right? Danger, fear, whatever, care. I'll play with what you like. But if it's going to cost me money, now I've got to worry, right? So I don't want to be worried on Shabbos. So stuff that's like, if I've got like an antique set of, something, right? It's an antique pot. Why is that wrong with the pot? What's wrong with the pot? But it's antique, don't touch that, it could break. Right? That's worth a lot. Right? So that would be muksa now. It's something that's very valuable and it could break.
Expensive jewelry for a woman?
Expensive jewelry that was delicate, not like that would be delicate.
I mean, it might be stolen.
Huh?
You'd be worried that maybe someone's going to steal it.
So here, cheson kis. Well, from loss of money, I guess.
Just breaking.
Usually they bring being broken. I don't know about being stolen, if you're worried about it being stolen. Maybe, it's also a cheson kis. So the one we said about the shechita knife, so he brings over here, the shechita knife is given an example, not on Shabbos because you can't use it anyway, because it's only for killing animals, but on Yom Tov you could use it. But even on Yom Tov it's now muksa because of cheson kis.
But you can slaughter in Yom Tov.
No, it's the other way around. It's muksa on Shabbos, but not on Yom Tov when you can use it to slaughter. You would be using it on Yom Tov, but...
But you don't want anyone else handling it.
Right.
Because it's very sharp, and you want to keep it very sharp.
You're not worried about your kid getting killed. You're worried about the thing breaking.
Yeah, you're worried about it getting damaged.
What happens to
Tom, okay, that's number one. Number two, a kli,
a vessel.
Shemalachto l'isur. A kli that its use is forbidden. So that's a classic, right? The classic one that we would all say is muksa. Something that where the way you use it would be a malacha, would be a forbidden use, right? A camera, right? Tom, any electronic good, right? The way of using it would break Shabbos. So that is a reason that it's now muksa. Right, even though it's turned off, right? Your electric mixer, your blender, it's not plugged in. But if you were to use it, it would be muksa. So even though it's not plugged in, you're not allowed to move around the kitchen because it's still muksa. Tom, number three, muksa mechamat gufo. Muksa because of its...
TV
is muksa.
So let's say you turn it on Shabbat.
If you turn it on TV before Shabbat, you're still not allowed to touch it.
It's to see. So you cannot see?
Can't look at, no. Yes, you're allowed to look at muksa. Nothing wrong with looking at muksa. The only thing is moving it.
You can use only when you see.
You're allowed to use it. No, its use means that when you turn it on, you're breaking the malacha when you switch on. Like a blender or anything.
There's people that will put on a World Series before Shabbos, they'll put on their TV, so
right.
On Shabbos.
So there's not...
It'll
Halakhically, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not very Shabbistic, and it's not advisable.
Right.
People do it, but it's not an ideal to go on Shabbos. Right? Top. But there's nothing wrong with seeing or listening or like a radio that's switched on.
Because you know how many you have to use TV, you turn on the then you go.
I hear. But in order to use it, you have to. Otherwise, it doesn't do anything.
But having a TV on, doesn't that separate? You mentioned three categories, namely,
yeah.
You would lose the distinction between Shabbos or Yom Tov and the weekday.
But you switched it on. You did the action before Shabbos. Here we're talking about you're not actions that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. You're not doing anything on Shabbos that's breaking Shabbos. You're just walking past, listening to it. You're not doing anything. You can't be punished for looking or listening or hearing.
But it's not a good idea.
It's not a good idea. You're right. But that's
not. I know when there was the war in Gaza.
Yeah.
Many people left the radio.
Oh, all right. So that was for a good reason, right? And there was radio stations that are silent the whole time unless there's a warning. So you leave it on the silent station until. Okay. So that was number two. Number three, Moksa Mechamet Gufo. Right. This is Moksa because of its Gufo, meaning because of what it is itself, not how to use it. Like the other ones, in order to use it, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with a blender. There's nothing bad at it, right? It doesn't do anything. It's just a blender. When you switch it on, that's its malacha. So that was section number two. When you use it, but something even itself is Moksa. What's examples? The example are dead animals, right? Which themselves, you can't do anything with a dead animal on Shabbos. And same to frozen meat or the can of whatever we said, that you can't cold beans. If you don't
dead person it. Also, you can.
Dead person, right? They're Moksa because of Mechamat Gufo. You're not going to do anything with them that's going to break Shabbos, right? But the object itself is intrinsically not Shabbistic. You're not going to use it on Shabbos. Something that's not ready to use, that it is itself not able to use on Shabbos or anything, is Moksa. It also include things like stone, like things people don't realize are Moksa, stones. Right? You're not allowed to walk around the street and kick a stone. Right? A stone is actually Moksa on Shabbos. You're not allowed to pick up a stone. Right?
But if you find money, you can cover it with a stone. Can you?
Because then you're using the stone for a specific purpose. If you need a stone to keep your door open, your door keeps blowing in the wind. Right? And you want to get, so you're allowed to go in the garden, pick up a nice stone, if it's a Eruv. Right? And so you can use a stone. But if it's not for a reason on Shabbos, then it's Moksa. That's why you have a person has to, like, to keep the laws of Shabbos. It's not simple.
Easy. It's
not simple. Huh? Tov, that was number three. Number four, a basis, le devar ha'asur. A basis, nice English, nice Hebrew word to translate, a base. Basis. Something that's a base for something else that's Moksa. So something itself is not Moksa, it's perfect, but it's now got something on it that is Moksa. So for example, a pillow, nothing wrong with a pillow, but if you left your wallet on the pillow, so now the pillow's Moksa.
Can't push it off.
So there's different things you can do in order to try and rectify the situation, but something that's a base for Moksa also takes on the laws of Moksa, even though there was no reason to, 5 minutes ago it wasn't Moksa, but now it is. Called a basis. There's different rules that apply to it, some things.
So there's a chair, let's say a chair.
A chair.
There's money.
Yeah. Meaning
you can't touch it?
Meaning you can't move it. You can't use it. So there were different things you can do. Sometimes you can move it off. Sometimes depends what type of Moksa it is, and it depends how you move it.
If you have a frozen piece of meat on a cabinet, if can't open the cabinet.
So that, for example, there are problems, and again, a person should buy a Mukzah book from their favorite Jewish bookshop to review them. For example, you're looking in the freezer for, some ice cream for your Shabbos meal, and in the way is a piece of frozen meat. Are you allowed to move the meat out the way to get to the... can be problematic. Sometimes, no, you can't. Sometimes, you have to look and check and see. Or even in the cupboard at cans, if I want to get this can, it's behind that can. It's not so obvious what you can do. If something's mukzah, you can't move it. You have to think what's to check and see where's the ice cream in the freezer.
Clothes. Let's say you have clothes as well, so there's only clothes, so you cannot.
I think that's okay. Yeah. Why? Because okay. Mukzah trousers are fine. You can wear them.
It's like.
So a picket, it's like boreh, like choosing, yeah. Boreh. Could be. Boreh is also a whole other issue, right? How do you get knives and forks out of the, if I want this, is it boreh? Depends, things that mix within itself, you could argue it's not boreh, but and lots of rules that we can still learn. Okay, so that was number four, a base. Huh?
We were learning of the Shabbos.
So we were learning. Everything is open. We're learning everything. Top. Number five. Mechubar u'mechusar seida. Something which is attached or which is not yet trapped. Something which is attached, like a fruit that's attached to a tree or any right? Or that's not yet trapped, like an animal that's not trapped. So they're also mukzah, to touch. What does it mean? It means, if it were to become, for example, the fruit you wouldn't use anyway because it's stuck to the tree. So that would be a malacha to pick. So why do I need a law of mukzah? So here we're talking about if it fell off. If it fell off the tree during Shabbos, so it's now, it was attached during Shabbos, it now has the law of mukzah. I can't eat an apple. I can't pick up the apple that fell off the tree during Shabbos because of the mukzah. Hello, Rabbi. Okay. Hello. We'll take a pause to welcome. Rabbi Mordi's not here this week, so we're just going to go through Beitza a little bit. So we're just starting now with
Mukzah.
So we're learning the laws of Mukzah. So that's Mukzah. Mukzah level number five. That also trapping. Trapping is also in this rule. In terms of meaning what? An animal that hadn't been captured by Shabbos, you're not allowed to trap it on Shabbos. Right, so this is specifically talking about Yom Tov, when you are allowed, because otherwise you wouldn't be allowed to trap it anyway on Shabbos. But on Mukzah, but on Yom Tov, you wanted to eat it, so you have to tie it up first the day before if you want to shecht it on Yom Tov. On Yom Tov itself, if it's not yet trapped, then it's asur to trap it here, apparently because of the laws of mukzah, not necessarily because of the laws of trapping.
So this doesn't mean things like putting a chicken in a chicken coop.
Could be. And cats.
Why? You have to put your chickens in America. If you don't put them back in the thing, the raccoons will finish them.
Yeah, but you're not allowed to break Shabbos just because you're going to lose your chickens.
It's
maybe rabbinically. Maybe rabbinically for...
it's your fault if they eat enough, so... You
don't take them out. I don't know. Then so you have to ask your...
Ask for
it's
forbidden
to take
anyone.
That's trapped. That's not trapped to trap it. So it depends what trapped means. And for what sort of animal. Like a dog... that is in the house and you want to put a lid on it to take it for a walk, is that called trapping? Don't know. Probably not, because I haven't seen it.
So when let's say you sit in the cat jump over you.
You see one? A cat?
Cat jump. You
but you didn't trap it.
They come, jump
but you didn't trap
you.
It.
You take it now, it's like
so animals themselves are muksa for a different reason. Animals themselves are muksa because of Mechamat Gufor, the one we learned about the dead people and the stones. That also includes animals. Animals that are muksa on Shabbat. But Tov, you should speak to your local Orthodox rabbi about whether or not that applies to all animals these days. And like, for example, domesticated animals may not be muksa on Shabbos. That could just be wild animals. So, Tov, I know your cats are wild, but they may be cows are domesticated. Tov, that was number five. Two more left.
Does that include teenagers?
Teenagers, yeah, they're some wild animals. Try to trap one of them in the room, right? No chance. It's forbidden. Okay. Nolad, number six. Something that's born, created on Shabbos is muksa. Nolad. Nolad.
Nolad.
Now, I don't know why, but it doesn't include children. Rav Yosef, why does a nolad include kids? Something that's just been born is muksa. It's born on Shabbos. Why does it include kids? Nolad.
You neglected your baby.
Yeah, I know, but nolad. It's obviously right, but I know. So maybe it is, but just because of otherwise, it's don't touch it, right? But other things that aren't small animals, small children, that are born on Shabbos, which is where we get the name of this masechet from Beit Zah, an egg that is born on Yom Tov, right? It is muksa, right? So that's an example of nolad, section number six, of something that's muksa, something that's created anew today. Didn't exist before Shabbos, before Yom Tov, and it's born on Yom Tov. Came into being on Yom Tov. It's muksa for that reason.
Kind of like the fruit that fell off the tree.
Kind of like the fruit that fell off the tree. It's now ready to be used on. And number seven, muksa lemitzvato. Le mitzvato. It's muksa because it's been set aside for a mitzvah, which is it sounds counterintuitive, right? Your kiddush cup isn't muksa, right? But the way of using the kiddush cup is to pick it up but other things which don't have that functionality. The classic example is
It's your Pesach kiddush cup and it's Shabbos, it's muksa.
If it's your Pesach, yeah, but for a different reason.
Right. Has no purpose.
Has no purpose, right, but not from the account of the mitzvah itself. So here
you can just buy yourself a new one and use that one.
If you declare to use it for Shabbos, I'm going to now make it pay a hummus stick. But here the classic example is
Sukkot. Can you do that on Shabbos?
What? Yeah, decide.
It's called Noah, no? It's something that can be used.
Yeah, but you're allowed to take your hammer and use it to crack nuts, even though you
on weren't Shabbos,
on Shabbos. So here the classic example of something that's set aside for mitzvah, sukkah decorations and the sukkah itself. You're not allowed to touch them on the chag. Why not? So the answer is because of this seventh category of muksa, which is called because it's been set aside for the mitzvah. Why? I have no idea. Like what the hashkafa is, I don't know.
But that seems strange because isn't there a custom to have hanging fruit in your sukkah?
Yes, you know that. Yeah, but not on Yom Tov. In fact, not during the whole Chag, I don't think.
Ah, okay.
I think certainly not on Yom Tov. I don't know about the rest of the Chag. La mitzvah.
Meaning that you put up the decorations for a mitzvah, and then therefore we're not allowed to touch it.
Yeah. It says here, such items as the wood of a sukkah and its ornaments. Tov. There we have the summary guide to the Lord of Offer. I'll take this chance to make a plug for a new book to the edition of the Library of Kutshal Chesed English Department. This is a wonderful book. Everyone should read it and should buy copies and give it out and do hafatzah with it. It's one of the most strongest pieces of Uman propaganda that exists in the world.
Stolen
at night. Have you read it in Hebrew? It's a written in Hebrew. Oh, just come out in English. You read it in Hebrew?
No, I've heard it. It
yeah, it's amazing.
You're selling them?
Huh?
Where do you buy it?
From the end of today, you can buy it on Amazon. But before then, you can...
You don't have access to internet.
You can get it in the Breza bookstore. I'm going to speak to Yosef, see he's going to stock it over there.
What's it called? Stolen Light?
Stolen Light.
And who wrote it?
My wife, which is why I'm plugging it. It was it's written by Yitzhak Leibovich, who's an Israeli playwright. It's a true story of a person who went to Uman, and a secular Jew who went to Uman, and what happened to him, and all the people he met, and all the stories. Anyway, so the Yitzhak Leibovich is an Israeli playwright. He heard about this guy and went to find him and said, you've got to write this up as a book. So he found the guy, and they wrote it up as a book. And that's the book. It's amazing. Yeah.
And you said your wife wrote it?
No, she translated it.
She translated
it. Yeah. And I managed to translate the odd little bit myself. Okay. Tov. So let's open Daf Bet Amud Aleph. Mishnah. Beitza. So. Beitza shenolda b'yom tov. An egg that was born on Yom Tov. It was laid on Yom Tov.
Do
you need to talk to all? No. I have no idea, actually. I just started to teach it. We'll do, like, I know, I guess till like 10:30.
Why don't we just have Chavrusas and then go
over? Oh, yeah? Do you want to do that instead? Do you want to do Chavrusas now and then?
Yeah.
We'll wreck right in the middle of this.
That way I could,
we haven't started yet, so.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And we can go over it. See
okay.
What's wrong.
Any other comments, views?
Yeah. I prep,
and then we'll go through.
Your heads over.
Okay. Fantastic. Okay. So. Tov. With Hashem's help, we're learning together. Sechet Beitza. At the beginning. Daf Bet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah.
That's 2A.
2A. For those studying in the English language. Right. Okay. So we're going to see now. The Mishnah has three cases. Three separate cases. The Mishnah. Case number one. Beitza shenolda b'yom tov. What do we do with an egg that is born on Yom Tov? So, Machoket, Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai Amrim Tachal. Beit Shammai say, you can eat it. Beit Hillel Amrim Lota. Let's write them up, because we're going to refer back. Three cases of our Mishnah. Okay, case number one. Machoket, Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel. What is the case?
An egg that is laid on Yom Tov. They're excluding Shabbos because you can't cook an egg on Shabbos.
You're right. That's a good reason for excluding Shabbos. You could also eat it. So that's
raw.
Why don't I just say that there's two prohibitions actually in Mokstam. One is to touch it, to move it. You don't have to touch it as long as it doesn't move. So one prohibition is moving. Second one is eating. Here it deals with eating. Obviously, to eat it, you've got to pick it up anyway. But there is a second law that's being taught to you, you're also not allowed to eat it. Right, so the first case, case number one, two, three cases. First case is the case of egg born on Yom Tov. Right, that's the case. What do each hold? Which shall I hold? Which shall I hold? Eat it. Permitted. Permitted. Hillel, says, forbidden. Not allowed to eat it. Right?
To eat it.
Next case of the Mishnah. Tzor and Chametz. What is the law of Tzor and Chametz? So here we're talking about Pesach. The Torah has two different rules. Right? We just assume Chametz. But actually the Torah says it in two different versions. One version the Torah says, Shivan Yamim Tzor Lo Yimtzah B'Pavat Teichem. 7 days Tzor shouldn't be in your house. And elsewhere the Torah says, Lo Yireh Lecha Chametz. You won't have Chametz. So there's two different things. One's Tzor, one's Chametz. We're going to see here in the there's two different laws. At least according to Beis Shammai. So Tzor is leaven. Chametz is Chametz. Well, we have to be all Chametz. What's leaven? Leaven is like yeast. Stuff that makes things.
Sourdough.
Huh?
Or sort of sourdough.
Sourdough.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm not such a baker myself, so
there's
yeast, days.
Which makes bread rise, and there's sourdough, which is dough that's left to sour.
Yeah, and here we're talking about
bread like
right, here we're talking, we're not talking about yeast itself. Yeast itself is perfectly fine, it's not chametz or anything, it's doing until you actually do something with it. It's just
the hand yeast back then.
No, yeah, they just used the dough, they took a bit from each one and kept it going.
Right.
The starter.
Starter.
Right.
Mixture. Right, so here, we're going to see that Beit Shammai are a lot more strict with leaven than they are with chametz. Why? Because leaven is more powerful than chametz. It's, well, that's one of the explanations that maybe other.
You can create more.
You can. It's a supercharged chametz-making facility. And I guess therefore you have therefore you have to be careful with it in terms of the amount that you can have lying around. Right, so here we're talking about not the amount you can eat. Right, everyone holds kosher. Not any chametz, kosher, any smallest amount you're not allowed to eat. So what we're talking about here, we're talking about the amount you can't see or find. Right? Which means that when you're cleaning for Pesach, obviously for next year, because we're passing that, but you don't have to. If you find a Cheerio lying around, you haven't broken any law. It's not Torah or anyone, because it's not a kazayit. If you eat it, you have, but just to have it in your home to find it, you're not liable. This is what they're discussing here. When are you liable? So there's an argument now between a kazayit and a kovaret, a date and a kazayit. Right, that's the amount you need in order to break the law. That's what they're discussing here in this second part of the Mishnah. How much do you need to have of a we'll call it leaven and chametz? How much before you're asur? So Beit Hillel says easy, you need a kazayit for both. Right, but Beit Shammai says different. Machloket Beit Shammai says he agrees in the case of chametz. You also says you need.
The opposite.
Right. In the case of leaven, you also need kazayit. But he's more lenient in the case of chametz, where he says you don't need a. You're not liable until you have a koveret, which is the size of a date. Right, which is bigger than a kazayit. Obviously, dates bigger than an olive. Right? So he's more lenient. Right? At this point, if you look at Rashi, Rashi now answers the question as to what is the connection? Why bring the case of Pesach Hametz measurement in the laws of Boxer and Yom Tov? Like the whole tractate we're going to see, the whole Gemara is all about Boxer and Yom Tov, what he could do. Who decided to fit this in? Right? What's the relevance of putting it in here? Rashi answers that question as the Rashi says. So Kazai, the second Rashi. Mishur Dahani Tlat Mile Habu Mekule. Because these are the three things which Habu Kule, Beit Shammai, Mechamoe, Beit Hillel. These are three things where we see that Beit Shammai are lenient as opposed to Beit Hillel, who are more strict. Right? Whereas, what's the normal rule? Normal rule, as we know, is the Beit Hillel is more lenient. Right? We follow Beit Hillel, generally speaking. In these three things, who do we follow?
In these three cases.
Aren't
there normally seven things that we follow for Beit Shammai? But Beit Shammai?
Don't know. No, that's Shammai and Hillel. And these are three of them.
Right.
So they're brought together here because these are three places where, three of the six anyway, where Beit Shammai is more lenient than Beit Hillel. But normally Beit Hillel and the rest of Shas is more lenient, which is why we follow Beit Hillel, because we're not to the standards of Beit Shammai yet. So that's why we're talking about different subjects in the same Mishnah. Usually the Mishnah deals with one subject. Why are we jumping around to different subjects? Answer, because these are all cases whereby Beit Shammai is more lenient.
Even though the second case has nothing to do with the first or the third?
Apparently not the service anyway. You might find the first that kind of connected, but generally speaking, now we're talking about two different topics. This is talking about the laws of Pesach and how much chametz you need to have. And this is talking about the laws of Muktzah when something's born on Yom Tov. And the third case, we're back to Muktzah. Third case, Hashochet Chaya Va'of B'Yom Tov. Someone who slaughters an animal, Chaya or an off, either, doesn't matter, on Yom Tov. What's the rule? So we know there's a rule that you need to cover up the blood. If you slaughter an animal, the Torah says you need to cover up its blood. What do you do on, here we're dealing with Yom Tov or Shabbos, how do you cover up the blood? What do you do normally use to cover up the blood?
You sprinkle dirt over it.
You put dirt on it. Where do you get the dirt from? What's wrong with that?
You're digging a hole.
So you're not allowed to do that. Also, we've learned separately that earth or stones is muksa as well. Right? So there's two issues there. But here we're talking anyway on Yom Tov, because you're not allowed to slaughter an animal anyway on Shabbos, it's not a question. So here we're talking about where you do slaughter it on Yom Tov. What is the rule? So again we see Machloket Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, and again we see in this case also that Beit Shammai is more lenient. Beit Shammai says, if you do this, Beit Shammai on Rim, Yachfor B'deker V'yachaseh, you can dig with a spade and cover it. Beit Hillel on Rim, Lo Yishchot, you're not allowed to slaughter an animal on Yom Tov, Ela in Ken Haya Lo Afar Mocham Mibod Yom, unless you had some earth prepared already for you to use. If you did that, then otherwise you're not allowed to slaughter. So case number three is covering blood on Yom Tov. Right? Beit Shammai says, did it cover? Beit Hillel says, not permitted unless prepared beforehand. Can't do it. But if you did do it, the Mishnah continues, Umodim, he agrees, Beit Hillel that is, She'im Shacha, if he did it for the Eved, after the fact, She'yachpor B'deka B'yikaseh, but you can do it. So this is a rule Lachat Chila. Right? Lachat Chila, you're not allowed to do it, but for the Eved, if you did, and you're then you have to do it anyway. Why? Because the law of the Torah says that you need to do it. It's a mitzvah day of the Torah. Rabbinically, you're not allowed to touch mukzah. So the Torah law is going to override that. But yeved, if you already did it, you're going to have to cover it up because you've now got a Torah law that you need to comply with. You need to cover it up. So but yeved, if you did it, so you dig and cover. The Mishnah finishes by saying, She'efah kira mochanchu, that the ashes of a kira, of a stove, are considered to be prepared.
So just an add-on.
Right. So the Gemara is gonna talk about what's that doing here, right?
It's better to use that.
Huh?
It's better to use that for kira than to dig, according to Beit Shammai.
Right. Because that's
don't
already.
Dig, unless you and if you don't have this stuff, then dig. We
right.
Use this for. Don't they use sawdust nowadays? Also, yeah, they use sawdust.
Yeah. Top. Okay, so again, we see in the third case, Beit Shammai says you can dig, right? Beit Shammai's lenient says you are allowed to use the earth. So in three cases here, we've now seen Beit Shammai a lenient, right there. Beit Shammai, lenient, and Beit Hillel is strict. Top. Okay. Good so far. Yes. Yeah. So, let's see what the Gemara is going to ask now. Gemara starts with a question, like it usually likes to start. But my askina, what are we dealing with here? What are we talking about? What is our case? What are we referring to? So, if we don't know, usually the beginning, right? We start off, Gemara doesn't say which case, we just have three cases. So we have three cases, and the Gemara says, what are we dealing with? Or which one? So, the beginning one, if in doubt, you're starting at the beginning till you learn otherwise. Right, so we're dealing with the first case. Right, the case of the egg that was born on Yom Tov. The Gemara says, what is the case of this chicken? If we're talking about a chicken that we were going to eat anyway, right? Basically the chicken that is in the chicken coop, we're going to eat her anyway at some point. We didn't have to eat her on Yom Tov. Don't necessarily intend that we're going to eat on Yom Tov, but at some point we're going to have chicken pie. My Tamai Hu Beit Hillel. What is the reasoning of Beit Hillel? Right, remember Beit Hillel said no, said you're not allowed to eat this egg. So Gemara says, if this chicken you're going to eat anyway, then how could Beit Hillel say it's a problem to eat the egg? Why? What's the connection? That's a chicken and that's an egg. Show, okay, you're going to eat the chicken, but now it's got an egg. How is that a problem for Beit Hillel? So the Gemara explains why that would be a problem for Beit Hillel. Uchla d'ifratu. Uchla, it's food that is separated from it.
Designated?
No, separated.
Separated.
What does it mean? He's saying like this. If you're going to eat the chicken, then you would also have to say that the egg should be fine too, because the egg is just part of the chicken. It doesn't matter that it was separated from it. It's like separating food from food. The egg, what you could have eaten yesterday when it was inside the mother's innards, if you would have slaughtered this animal and stuck it in a pot, you would have eaten the egg. Just because you've now taken the egg out, or the egg came out by itself, doesn't mean that it's any different. It's not a different entity than the original piece of food that it came out of. Yeah, it makes sense. If you say you were going to eat the chicken anyway, and it doesn't matter that the egg was born on Yom Tov, because we could have eaten the egg yesterday as well. I could eat it it's just part of the chicken. I was going to eat it all. I would have eaten it anyway. So if I say that this chicken was a chicken I would have eaten, then Beit Hillel would have a problem in saying it's forbidden. Because there's no reason to forbid it. Yeah.
I have a mafrich on there.
You have a what on it?
Mafrich.
Okay. Okay. No argument against it. Yes.
A calf. A slunk. You know what slunk is?
Slunk?
Unborn calf.
Okay.
You slaughter a cow, there's a calf in its womb.
Yes.
Does not need slaughtering.
Correct.
Okay?
Yes.
But if you wait a day and it's born, it needs slaughtering.
Okay. So you can say there is a difference.
Yeah.
But that's in the law of slaughtering. That's not necessarily in the law of food. It's still food.
Egg doesn't need slaughtering.
Not in the law of mixed muksa. It's a difference in the law of...
The question is... But when a Tanya God is born out of the egg, if you don't eat it, you will need slaughtering.
No, but what Rav Yochai is bringing is, we're saying that there's no difference between the egg that's inside the chicken that you would eat and the egg that pops out. The food separated from food is still considered food. But Rav Yochai is saying there is a difference, because we see in the laws of Shechita that there is a difference between food that's inside the
animal.
So that's the answer. The answer is, by Shechita there's a difference.
Yeah.
But there's no difference. Huh?
The meat, what's inside in the cow, it's not like you can eat the meat together.
The milk that's inside.
It's
not until it comes out.
No, I don't think so.
You can't eat an udder. You can't cook an udder with the milk in it.
No, I don't think that's
what
I think. You're thinking of something else.
But the milk was when you slaughter a cow, the milk is inside in the cow when you slaughter.
Yeah.
Or the milk inside is not in this.
You can eat with the milk together.
Okay, maybe that is the milk inside the cow that wasn't milk.
I assume so, because you don't out all the milk before. You couldn't anyway, because there's still going to be some milk.
You can make cheese.
Can
you make
cheese?
Start a business. No, only if it was cooked. You separate it from it.
Cheeseburgers.
Once you separate it from it.
What?
Maybe once you separate it from it.
Maybe this is the answer to all those.
Any views on milk that's in an animal?
Is it milk?
It's rare.
Can you cook an udder with milk in it?
Who cooks udders anyhow?
If you were hungry, it's a shiloh.
Yeah.
Don't know. Okay.
The other guy was there.
Homework. Rabbi Google.
or
just go look up whatever.
The other guy might want some udders.
We can. I believe then I can ask about,
Tov.
Ben Moshe.
Okay, so that's the question in the Gemara. The Gemara says, wait a minute, what type of egg hen are we talking about? If we're talking about a hen that you were going to eat anyway, so it shouldn't be a problem. It should be a problem for Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel shouldn't forbid it, because it's just food. Food today, food tomorrow. Doesn't matter if the egg came out or not, you're going to eat it anyway. Part of the chicken. Okay. So therefore, we can't be talking about that, because if we were talking about that, there wouldn't be a machloket here. Everyone would agree that it should be okay. So it can't be that type of chicken. Must be the other type of chicken. What's the other type of chicken?
chicks designated for laying eggs.
One that you weren't going to eat. For example, that you it was an egg-laying chicken, right? And those ones you don't eat. Why? Because you want eggs from it, so you're not intending to eat it, because then you would cut the... Aesop fable about cutting, chopping, shefting the chicken that laid the golden eggs? Right? You don't chef your chicken that lays eggs, because otherwise you're not going to... Even if you think there's gold inside, then there isn't.
If it makes too much noise, you'll shut them.
Okay. Elabatana golet harmedet legadel beitzim. Rather, must be talking about here a case of a tarnagot, of a chicken that is set aside for laying eggs. We're not going to shecht it. Because we're not going to shecht it, it means that it's not food separated from food. It means that this is a newly created entity. And therefore, it's muksah, which is why Beit Hillel say you're not allowed to eat it. But then that brings us the question, well, how can Rabbi Beit Shammai say it's okay then? How can they allow it? So that's the question the Gemara is going to ask now. If we go the other way and say, what type of chicken must it be? It must be the other type. Well, that's good for Beit Hillel. You've got an answer now. But what does Beit Shammai say about it now? How can he allow you to eat something that's been born anew? My Tamai, to Beit Shammai. Muksahi, should be muksa. Gemara answers that kashya's like this. Well, my kushya, what's your problem? What's your kushya here? Why do you think it's a kashya have a problem? Dilma, maybe. Beit Shammai, late luhu muksa. Maybe Beit Shammai don't consider this muksa.
Obviously.
Which seems like a... But why does the Gemara say that? Because for the following reason. We're going to see in the rest of the Gemara that there is a machloket, there's a fundamental machloket on the laws of muksa between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Shimon is lenient in the cases of muksa, and Rabbi Yehuda is more strict. Right? Throughout Shas in different places, there's a dispute, an ongoing dispute. Everybody agrees with muksa. But what's a dispute? The extent of muksa. Rabbi Rabbi Shimon versus Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Shimon is more lenient in the cases of muksa. What does that mean? Rabbi Yehuda is more strict. He's more lenient in that he says that muksa doesn't apply in all the cases that Rabbi Yehuda says is muksa. Rabbi Yehuda has far more cases. What's the main dispute where we find that they show their different positions is in the laws of Shabbat, is in Masechet Shabbat, where they're discussing what happens to oil in a candle. So in that case over there in Masechet Shabbos, Rav Shimon is more lenient. He says that oil, if the candle goes out and there's oil left in the container, you can use the oil. If you need it, you can use it for whatever you need it. You can put it on your chips, whatever you use oil for, right? You can use it for good reason. But Rav Yehuda is more strict and said, no, you're not. It was muksa at the beginning of Shabbat, and therefore it stays muksa throughout Shabbat. Even if the circumstances change, you can't change the designation of where something that was muksa can now not become unmuksed during Shabbos. So we see that in Shas there is already machloket as to the extent of muksa, when muksa applies, when muksa doesn't. So the Gemara says over here, maybe Beit Shammai, the dispute of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, is the same dispute as Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Beit Shammai, who are lenient, say the egg is permitted, they go like Rabbi Shimon. They're more lenient in the case of the muksa, that muksa doesn't apply in every case. And they say here too, in the case of Nolad, there's no muksa in the case of Nolad. Whereas Beis Hillel are more strict, like Rabbi Yehuda, say that Nolad is also a case of Muksa. So what's the Gemara say?
But in the case of fruit from a tree, I think they're not more lenient.
And what in the fruit of it?
A fruit.
Yeah.
That falls from a tree.
Yeah.
It's also no lad. But I think in that, Beit Shammai is not lenient.
So there, the fruit that falls from a tree is also in a second category of Muksa we learned earlier. It's also in the category called. In the category of something that was attached to a tree at the beginning of the Shabbos. Top. Anyway, let's continue with the Gemara. The Gemara says, Dilma Beit Shammai Leit Lehu Muksa. Maybe Beit Shammai hold that there's no Muksa here. Right, which is permitted. We see that there's a ruling of different machloket on what is muksa and what is not muksa. Gemara says, "Kasal kadatin afilu man deshare b'muksa." You might have thought that even the one who permits muksa, benolad asar, would prohibit it in the case of nolad. What does the Gemara mean? What does the Gemara mean? The Gemara, what does the Gemara mean by saying that? Kasal kadatin. What do? My time I debate Shammai. In the case of no, even the wording of the Gemara is difficult here because it doesn't. There's apparently a question and an answer, but they're not so clear from the text. The question that the Gemara said is, "What's the problem here?" It's not a problem at all. We can just say that Beit Shammai follows the lenient opinion, and Beit Hillel follows the strict, and that's why we've got a machloket. And the Gemara says, you would have assumed, Kasal Kadatin, Afilu Man Dashari B'Muksa Monolad Asa, even the one who permits Muksa, you might have thought that even the one who permits Muksa would have said this is forbidden. My Tamai to Beit Shammai. Therefore, what's the reasoning of Beit Shammai? So he's answering the question with another question, unfortunately. So it's not, the wording's not so clear, at least not clear to me, how to formulate that into an answer. But basically, the gist of what he's saying is like this. I can say it outside, I can't really see it inside. He's saying outside like this. You ask the question. Maybe Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel follow the argument of Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda. The Gemara says, you're right, but you might have thought that that's not true. That actually, even though we have this argument, the one who said lenient would still have been strict in the case of Nolad. Therefore, our Mishnah comes to say that that's not the case.
So are they talking about whether the chicken was designated as food or whether it was designated as a layer?
So they're as a layer. So they're going with the second case. They're saying the second case is correct. We are talking about a chicken that was designated for his eggs. In that case, why is it that we have the opinion of Beit Shammai that is permitted, when really it should be forbidden? Answer, because Beit Shammai followed the rulings of Rabbi Shimon, which is to be lenient in cases even Nolad. The Gemara says, you might have thought that Nolad would be different, and that Nolad wouldn't fall into this argument. of being lenient or strict. Along comes our Mishnah to tell you, no, even in the case of Molad, Nolad, which is different than what we learned, when we learned Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda, we learned their positions from the laws of the oil on Shabbos. The oil on Shabbos, whether or not you can change a status mid-flow, it's muksa now, it's not muksa. It's not the case of Nolad. Nolad is a whole different case. Therefore, you might have thought that Nolad doesn't fall into that argument, and you can't say that this is a Beit Shammai Beit Hillel argument. Therefore, Kamash Balan, if you like, therefore, our Mishnah comes along to say, no, there is. Actually, they do follow. Just like you have the argument here, so too you have the argument here. Even in the case of Nolad, we have the argument of two different opinions. One says Nolad is permitted, and one says Nolad is not permitted.
Are they assuming that because Nolad is a completely different category of Muksa?
Yeah, yeah. You might have thought, yeah, that's why I need to have this Mishnah. Otherwise, if it was the same, I wouldn't need this. Right? Because I would just learn the same argument from here. I can learn it from Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, or I can learn it from Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda. They're both equally valid sources. Why do you need to bring me another case if it's the same? Because this is different. This is the case of Nolad. And you might have thought, that's the wording that I get, you might have thought that here it's the same, that the one who's lenient would have even been strict. Answer no. The one who is lenient is even lenient here. Meaning, we wouldn't have known. We need this case because it's a different case.
So if we used another example of a different category of muksa,
yeah,
we may or may not have the same problem.
Correct. Do we learn this argument of lenient and strict follows through all cases of muksa, or only certain cases, and which cases? So here we're learning that in the case of Nolad, we need to have this dispute, because otherwise we wouldn't have known it by ourselves. We could have argued, you could have thought, there was room to say that Nolad falls outside of this argument. Therefore, I wouldn't have known what to have done with it. I would have said Nolad actually is strict. Like even the lenient one is strict, the Gemara says. You might have thought that even the lenient one is strict in the case of Nolad. No, along comes our mission to say no. There is still two opinions, one allows it, one permits it. That's why we have the math pocket. And that's why it's in the Seder. Okay. Again, or all good? Review one more.
My question.
Yeah.
Because all this here is lenient.
In other cases.
In all other cases.
Yeah.
You cannot learn from this the same. So, like, you take Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda, but the other story. See?
Yeah.
So now Hillel is always lenient. Now these two cases is like strict.
So that's why it comes to teach you a case. No, because we don't need to know Rabbi Hillel's opinion if it's not a chiddush, if it's not new. Even if he is strict, and it would be a chiddush for Rabbi Hillel, that we know that Rabbi Hillel doesn't normally say that. So it's interesting, but it's not enough that the Gemara would bring it. Unless it was telling us something new that we didn't know.
Question?
Yeah.
Is it a matter of lenience and strictness, or is it a matter of different understandings of what composes the need for something being muksa?
Here the Gemara is going with lenient and strict because it wants to maintain the parallel between Rabbi Shimon and
You're saying, I'm talking about both of them.
Yeah.
There could be different understandings of why something would be muksa.
Yes.
Often when you have...
Yes, but... I hear them.
Look at to understand what the right. Mindset is. You see, it's not a mahlokah.
Right, but...
different views.
So why are we saying... You know, Rashi specifically says here, these are three places where Beit Hillel is more strict.
Yeah.
Beit Shammai is more strict. Right, so... That's definitely the result. The result comes out as a cooler or chumra, as a strict leniency. The reason behind why they thought that is they might not consider it being strict.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why if we would understand, it might be easier to understand why it's this way.
Right, right. Yeah, when someone has a shita, whose shita is not, you know what, I'm going to be strict. There's no shita of strictness as a shita. As the shita is based on the underlying, what am I dealing with? What do I think about this case?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, there's no, there doesn't exist a strictness and a leniency. I'm going to be lenient. Well, on what? How? Why? Right? Every tana has his specific reason. Comes out that turns out to be a leniency.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to what? There has to be compared to someone else
mm-hmm.
who has a different opinion, and compared to his opinion, it turns out that he's more lenient, but only relative to someone else's view, which is a different, which is
that's
a fair, different view. Okay, top. So far, so good. Yossi, top. You know what? I think we're going to stop there. That's 5 to 12. Rather than start a new chunk. Huh?
You come to 12:30.
Who?
12. Who? It's now class number 12.
Oh, is the Rav Dror coming to... what's the...
He's coming.
Rav Chana?
Is
Rav Dror teaching at 12:30?
Yeah.
12 o'clock?
12 o'clock.
Okay, so fine. So we'll stop now and then we can have a break until Dror. Huh?